This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Award-winning local author Rick Britton is live in studio. He's online at rickbritton.com, and he joins us every week to count down the top 25 most significant Civil War battles that were fought here in Virginia. And thank you for your patience. We were to have spoken in the last half hour, but I appreciate you hanging around given this this national situation we're dealing
with. Well, you're welcome. Of course, this is pretty important what was going on.
Yeah. So we're continuing to track that. CBS will have a complete update for you, of course, at the top of the hour. But let us turn our attention back to the American Civil War. What are we talking about this week?
Well, this week we're talking about the Battle of Cedar Creek. And it was fought in the valley just south of Winchester and Middletown on October 19th, 1864. It's going to take a little bit of a setup to get us out there. The setup is pretty interesting. Following the Battle of New Market, which took place on May 15th, 1864, New Market, you remember, was the fight with the VMI cadets.
Yeah.
That was a huge Confederate victory. The Federal troops retreated en route back down the Shenandoah Valley, and the commander was relieved. Franz Sigel was relieved. He was replaced by David Hunter. His nickname was Black Dave Hunter, and he came back up the Shenandoah Valley. Some of the troops that had fought under Breckinridge, the Confederate troops, were sent to reinforce Robert E. Lee as he was facing Ulysses S. Grant. So when David Hunter comes back up the Shenandoah Valley, he was able to capture Stanton. Then he went on and took Lexington. He burned the Virginia Military Institute. He burned the governor's mansion there in Lexington, and then came over the mountains and threatened Lynchburg. So all of a sudden, with Grant and Lee kind of facing off and kind of deadlocked around Richmond and Petersburg, all of a sudden all eyes were turned to western Virginia, where things were a little bit more mobile out there, where the armies were still maneuvering. So Lee sent Early and a corps out there to stop Hunter, but he gave him some amazing directives. When you think about what was going on at the time, the directive was not just to stop Hunter, but to clear the Shenandoah Valley of the Federal troops. If he was able to do that, go down the Shenandoah Valley, and if possible, get into Maryland and threaten Washington, D.C. Why did Lee want Early to do all these things? Well, threatening Washington, D.C. would make Grant send reinforcements, probably from his army, since his army is the closest.
Yeah.
And that would relieve the pressure on Richmond and Petersburg.
What's that called? Is it just called a military diversion, or is it?
Yeah, a diversion.
Is there another name for it?
Yeah, it's a diversion.
Yeah.
So Early gets out there. He gets to Lynchburg just in time. Hunter is not all that great a commander, so Hunter, in his threat against Lynchburg, it was kind of feeble. So Early saves Lynchburg. Then Hunter, instead of retreating back down the Shenandoah Valley so he would close the corridor or keep the corridor safe, he retreated into what's now West Virginia, thus opening the door for Early to go all the way down the Shenandoah Valley. He fights a little battle outside of Frederick where he's successful, but the man who defended, the federal commander there was able to buy some time, but Early brushes his army away, lost a day doing that, and arrives at the northeast corner of the District of Columbia in Silver Spring, and they actually fight a little action at Fort Stevens. So the Confederate Army made it all to the very doorstep of the federal capital, and it's kind of—
Is that the closest that they got throughout the war?
That is the closest that they got in force like that. Of course, Mosby was operating, you know, all around the southern perimeter of the federal capital, but Abraham Lincoln actually went out there and in his top hat and tails and everything, climbed up on the parapet and looked down at this skirmishing that was going on until a federal officer, a federal captain, told him to get down, you darned fool. I think the language was actually a little bit more saucy than that. But that's one of only two times in American history that a president was actually on a battlefield and under fire. That was only the second time, and that's the last time that that's ever happened. that a person while president has been on a battlefield and under fire. Isn't that interesting?
And the first was?
The first was James Madison at the Battle of Bladensburg outside of Washington, D.C. And because we lost the Battle of Bladensburg, the British during the War of 1812 and 1814 were actually able to capture and burn Washington, D.C. But James Madison rode out to see the battlefield and accidentally rode past the American line. So for a while with his retinue was actually in between the Americans and the British under fire until somebody warned him and he turned around and he rode back.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So think about that. That's that's kind of silly, huh?
So, the Confederate troops actually get up to attack Washington, D.C.?
They actually do. They threaten Washington, D.C.
I never knew this happened.
What made it even more interesting is right there alongside Jubal Early is the former vice president of the United States, Breckinridge. So it would have been kind of interesting. They could have installed him, you know, marched into Washington, taken the Capitol, and installed him as the new president. But anyway, this, of course, infuriates the nation, infuriates Grant. Grant sends reinforcements from his army. He sends other reinforcements, a whole corps from Louisiana. And the idea is, you know, we've got to root out the Shenandoah Valley. We've got to clear it once and for all, and it got to get this menace. Of course, Early retreats back into the Shenandoah Valley. Grant goes up there and puts one of his best men in command of this new army that's created up there, and that's Philip Sheridan. And Philip Sheridan was very aggressive, of Irish background. Everybody said that he always looked like the kind of guy who was about ready to put his head through a brick wall, somebody who was very, very determined and determined to get the job done, much in the mold of Ulysses S. Grant and Sherman, who was operating, you know, elsewhere. So Sheridan gets in command and in two battles is able to defeat Jubal Early at the Battle of Winchester, Third Winchester, and then at Fisher's Hill. Early retires back up the Shenandoah Valley, and Sheridan thinks that he's got it cleared out. So Sheridan retires back up to just south of Middletown. And Middletown is about 14 miles south of Winchester. So if you can imagine the northern valley past the Massanutten, he puts his army in camp there, and they actually dig in. And they're alongside the northern face of Massanutten Mountain, just to the west of the northern face of Massanutten that divides the Shenandoah Valley in two. And then Sheridan, thinking that things were okay for now in the Shenandoah Valley, goes to a conference in Washington, D.C. So he goes away from the army and turns it over to his number two. Now, Early at this point is outnumbered 2-1 in the Shenandoah Valley, but he is determined that he can attack Sheridan's force and defeat it just south of Middletown along Cedar Creek. So what they did was they climbed up onto Massanutten Mountain. Two of his officers did, Gordon and the famous mapmaker, who was one of my first Civil War heroes as a kid, Jedediah Hotchkiss, the man who had been Stonewall Jackson's mapmaker, is now with Jubal Early in the valley and his corps serving out there. They climb up onto Massanutten Mountain, and from there, with a powerful glass, they can look down and they can see all of Sheridan's army encamped behind Cedar Creek, spreading out to the west. And they come up with this audacious plan, and audacious is definitely the word for it, and they go down, they present it to Jubal Early, and he approves. So with an army of 18,000 men, they determine to attack an army of over 30,000, and they are sure that they can defeat it. And here's the plan. The north branch of the—
And all of this that we're talking with Rick Britton, it's about 15 minutes until 5 o'clock. All of this, of course, is to just see who's going to control the valley, because the valley continues to be this highway.
The breadbasket.
Yeah.
And not just the highway, but the breadbasket of the Confederacy. I mean, the foodstuffs that are raised out there, the wheat and also the beef, that food is being sent to supply Robert E. Lee's army just outside of Richmond and Petersburg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also this highway that the Union troops can very easily, you know, go up the valley or south.
Right.
And then, you know, get over the mountains. And next thing you know, you're in Charlottesville, you're in Lynchburg, and you're on the doorstep of Richmond.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And both of those places are prime targets for the Union Army because both of them are rail centers. Charlottesville, especially because it's a junction of two railroads. So even more important to a certain extent than Lynchburg.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, absolutely true. Lynchburg important too, because it's on the James River, and it's on the James River Kanawha Canal. It's also being used to supply food to Robert E. Lee's forces outside of Richmond and Petersburg.
Rick, let's take a quick break, and then when we get back, we're going to hear about this battle again. This is the decisive battle that ended, really brought to an end, the Confederacy in the Valley.
Absolutely it is.
And it really marked the beginning that the Union troops from there on out to the end of the war would control the Shenandoah Valley. And we'll find out how that happened in just a moment. Rick Britton is live in studio. We are talking about the Battle of Cedar Creek in early summer of 1864. Is that right?
Actually, it's October. It's the fall of 1864.
Sorry,
19th
right.
of October. Yeah, and this plan, we were just talking about this Confederate plan. It's pretty amazing what they came up with. And they decided, Jubal Early and his commanders decided to commit 3/5 of his army. So 3 of the 5 infantry divisions were going to make this flank march. And if you can imagine, the Massanutten Mountain Range divides the Shenandoah Valley in two for 50 miles. We're talking about what happened at the northern face of the Massanutten Range. It's pretty high, Massanutten. The North Fork of the Shenandoah River runs along the north side of Massanutten, right up against the mountain. The left of the Federal works, the Federal encampments and the Federal earthworks, were anchored up against the North Fork of the Shenandoah. So they thought that their left flank was absolutely secure, and they thought that the base of the mountain and the slopes of the mountain there on the other side of the river, that was basically impassable terrain. But what the Confederates found was there was a footpath or an animal trace or a pig path. You mentioned you saw something on Wikipedia that referred to it to a pig path. That a pig path, so where the men would have to actually go in single file along the base of the mountain, would take them to a ford, Bowman's Ford, on the North Fork of the Shenandoah, and once they crossed Bowman's Ford, they would be astride the left flank of the Union Army. So they decided to make this march at night. So further to the south, they crossed the river on another ford, went along this pig path for several miles in single file.
Was there ever anything like that in the Civil War?
Sure, there are plenty of sneak attacks like this.
But this is single file along some animal path in the middle of the night?
This is a pretty amazing sneak attack.
Yeah, and
it's really, really audacious. And what's amazing about it is, initially, this thing works. So they get to Bowman's Ford, and we're still talking about the darkness now, in the middle of the night. They cross Bowman's Ford. They deploy the initial units on the other side, so they're able to attack the left flank of the Federal Army, who is completely unawares. I mean, they're still in their tents on the left flank as the morning mist is rising, and the Confederates come screaming out of this one direction that they thought was completely protected. So initially, this tack is a huge success, as you can imagine. They're not able to use their earthworks. Their earthworks are facing in the wrong direction. So the first corps that the Confederates encounter, they're sent to the rear en route. That's the 8th Corps. The 19th Corps is the next one they hit in flank by the left flank. They're routed and sent to the rear. So a good portion now of the Union Army that, remember, outnumbers them almost 2-1, a good portion of the Union Army is fleeing up the Valley Turnpike now to Middletown. So initially, this is a massive success for the Confederates. They pursue. One of the problems they encounter early on, though, is in order to pursue the Federals, they have to go through their camps. So this is something that starts happening early on. And remember, these guys were shaken out of their tents. These guys were driven out of their encampments. There's coffee boiling on the campfires. There's food in the tents. There's better clothing.
Don't tell me that slows the Confederates down.
Oh, absolutely it does. So early on, as they're driving them through the camps, men start straggling. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, a guy who maybe doesn't have good shoes. It's kind of hard to imagine him running past a pair of shoes that might be lying there right on the ground that perhaps fit him.
Yeah.
Or somebody who hasn't eaten in a couple of days, you know, actually walking past a frying pan that has some bacon in it. That guy, you know, that guy is going to fall out and he's going to stop and he's going to get that bacon and then he's going to try to catch up or maybe not even bother to try to catch up a little bit later on. So as they move through the camps, this straggling starts. Now, the battle lasts a good portion of the day. The morning, though, the Confederacy is still in its ascendancy, and they drive the Union forces back to the other side of Middletown. Then an amazing thing happens. Just the day before, Sheridan had been making his way back to his army, and he was up in Winchester. From Winchester in the morning, he can hear the gunfire. He can hear the cannons booming just to the south. So he gets on his horse, Renzi, and poems were written to this, songs were told of this, how Sheridan rides back, and on the way back, he sees some of the men still retreating, still retiring, and he rallies his army. Of course, this had already started. He's only encountering knots of stragglers and knots of men going to the rear. This had already been happening where they'd been solidifying their lines. But Sheridan arrives, you know, at a very perfect moment, rallies his army, and then counterattacks. And of course, because he outnumbers Jubal Early, when he counterattacks, all hell breaks loose. So everything that had been gained in the morning, all the artillery captured, most of the prisoners had been captured, most of the wagons that had been captured, those are taken back. And then the Confederate army is driven en route from the field, losing most of its artillery. So what started off as an amazing plan and an amazing victory in the morning ends up in just a horrible defeat for Jubal Early's army.
Amazing.
Yeah. And this is the last major battle fought in the Shenandoah Valley. And after this, there was no serious opposition to Union arms in the Shenandoah Valley.
Amazing. So that's the fall of 1864. Of course, the thing ends in the spring of 1865.
Right.
Or at least it does here in Virginia.
Another thing that's really interesting is this is happening in the middle of October, and what is happening just 3 months later? 3 weeks later, in early November, is the election of 1864.
And so this helped reelect Lincoln.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. All of a sudden, things are completely turned around in the Shenandoah Valley.
Amazing.
And it's looking a lot better.
Rick Britton, he's online at rickbritton.com. Thank you, Rick, so much.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.